a question we had in our clergy, Sindicimos in Utah. All the priests get together and we chat and have lunch. And there was somewhat of a, we're talking about a memorial service that was going to meet together to do it together with another priest. And I said, we need to get it done. It's the 40th day. And he said, come on, Father. It's no big deal. It's a Monday. It's a day off. And I said, no, it's really important in this 40 days. And he made a comment kind of like, well, those are really just for us. Those are just for the consolation of the living. And that really struck me as kind of heartbreaking. And I said, you know, a place of verdure, a place of brightness, a place of repose where there is no sickness or sorrow. But, and I felt very strongly that those prayers in the history of the church and patristics had saved people, were saving for people. So I know it's kind of peripheral what you mentioned, but if you could speak to that, the power of those services.
Well, that's the sort of secular intellectual psychologizing interpretation. Oh no, we're not praying for departed spirits floating around in some sort of, you know, light space. This is really about the grieving process, right? It's the psychological wisdom of the church. It's for the, you know, I mean, you hear this, right? You hear this. People will even try to find correlations between the memorial service and services and grief therapy and that sort of thing. I would say it is that. That's a part of it, but it's not just that. That's the problem. It's this debasing of everything and this reduction of everything. That's, somebody said this once, that's like saying that Michelangelo's Pietà is only marble. Or that's like saying a symphony by Bach is only sound waves, right? There's a lot more. I mean, okay, it is sound waves and it is marble. And it does help the people who are. And you get together at a funeral when somebody dies. It's traumatic. It's difficult. People are in shock. You can't even believe it. And the family comes together and no, it's just, what's going on? And it's so great to be able to come back 40 days later and as a family and with the hindsight and with the kind of major grieving already behind you and to get together once again, to go back to the grave, it's tremendously helpful, right? But that's only part of what the church is providing for us there. We are praying for the souls of the departed, just like we say. St. Paul, whether we live or whether we die, right? We're all part of the same body still, right? So, when a monk dies in a monastery, obviously the body is removed, is prepared for burial, taken from the cell, and then brought to the church, and the funeral service and the burial takes place. But the cell, when the body is removed from the cell to be taken to the church for the funeral service, the cell door is locked, and no one goes in the cell for 40 days. Right? Nothing is touched, right? Nothing is touched. And after 40 days, now why? I mean, we don't say why. We don't say, oh, well, because the spirit is still here, and we don't say that, right? But again, there are multiple reasons. I mean, maybe it is for the departed. It's also for us in a way. You don't go into somebody's room the day after they died and ransack their belongings, right? Let things be. And again, this 40 days, right? It's not just a magical number because it's repeated in the Bible. There must be something to it, right? So I think that answers your question. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. At the Council of Florence, where there were discussions about purgatory, St. Mark of Ephesus talks about there's a major treatise attributed mistakenly to John of Damascus about the efficacy or the efficaciousness of memorial services and the funeral service and these kinds of things. And even the commemoration of the dead in the liturgy. I mean, these later Byzantine writers who were required to sort of explain these practices all say that that the dead somehow can even feel these things, that there's some sort of aesthesis, there's some sort of awareness, or some sort of, and they can even experience a degree of relief of some kind if they're suffering or if they're, I mean, some of this takes us beyond what we can reasonably talk about, but that they have an effect. I mean, why would we do it otherwise, right? So. Yes, Father.
Father Patrick from Pomona, California. couple of questions have come up this week regarding heaven and hell, especially hell, whether it's created or not. It's a very interesting pastoral question because people worry about that. Lots of inquirers I usually have some kind of conversation with at their request, like, am I going to go to hell? Like, how can I keep from going to hell? And I have my way of treating that, but here at the conference, I was talking to one of the deacons about it, and I've usually used a talk that was given about 25 years ago, a short essay called The River of Fire, to help dislodge from the minds of catechumens that were formed in the Jonathan Edwards tradition of the, you know, the fiery God holding you over the fiery embers, you know, the angry God, a sinner in the hands of an angry God. So to kind of cure that, so that's enough maybe of a lead-in. Can you give us a little bit of something on that to help us with a good
huge topic, yeah. The first thing I'll say is in defense of poor Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards wrote hundreds and hundreds of sermons, and every anthology of Puritan-era sermons, that's the one they always, right? He was not, poor Jonathan Edwards, he was a great figure. He was not the fire and brimstone preacher of the popular imagination, that sinner's in the hand of an angry. For some reason that, you know, he got typecast with that one sermon. The man gave and is survived by hundreds of sermons. And some of them are so rapturously beautiful, right, that you wouldn't know that this is Jonathan Edwards because we all have that kind of anyway, so. This is a really big topic, and we could look at it from so many different points of view, and different writers approach it from different perspectives. And I mean, one of the things that I see coming through very strongly in the tradition is that, you know, heaven and hell are realities that we experience and participate in now. Heaven is not something, right, in the future. Hell is not something in the future. Heaven and hell are now. Right? And if you really want to scare people, tell them, what's your feeling now? What's your experience now? That's only going to intensify. Right? It's not going to, right? If you're living in, I mean, every day can be Christmas, every day can be Pascha, every day can be the Ascension for you. But for other people, Pascha is not even Pascha, right? Christmas is not even Christmas. So rather than, I mean, again, it's a distraction in a sense, right? To talk about these future possibilities is to distract people from the situation they're in now. Right? What's going on with the individual now? So, the way I was brought up, and again in the monastic tradition, I mean the emphasis is on what's going on now, the other thing is that, I mean, one of the reasons that I think the Patriarchate of Constantinople recently canonized Elder Porphyrius. We're all very happy they did. And some people have asked, well, why there were other modern elders, modern Greek elders, why did they pick him? And in a way, well, you could say he was a safe bet because there's really nothing about his teaching that's controversial. Some of the other elders, we might have to wait 50 or 100 years before, you know, some of that. And people talking about barcodes and the Antichrist, and you know, if you were to canonize an individual who promotes that kind of thing, it would be guilt by association, right? You would be canonizing the idea that, you know, whatever. Not that all of those things are innocent either. But I think in the case of the Elder Porphyrius, there's really nothing about his teaching that I find to be objectionable or peculiar or what have you. And of course, one of the things he stresses, he tells people, look, don't focus on demons. Right? Don't focus on hellfire. Focus on Christ. Focus on the love of Christ. Right? I think it's such a relief to be told that by such an incredible saint like Saint Porphyrius. Right? Don't live in fear. Right? Because then the fear ends up controlling us, and we end up, I don't know, people end up making deals with the devil at the end of it all. Right? Rather than turning to Christ, and I don't know if that's, I see you looking the other way, but I mean it's a big topic, and maybe it's not even a good idea to pursue it any further. But you know that life with God is paradise, that life with God is heaven, and that life without God is hellish. I mean that's enough for me to know. right? That's enough for me to. And there's a great book called The Diary of a Russian Priest by Ellen Chaninov, yeah? He says that if I found out one day that Christ was going to lose and that the devil was going to win, I would still stay with Christ, right? Because he's about love and compassion and forgiveness and, right? That's where you want to be, even if that's the losing side, right? So forget about all that other stuff and let's just, right? So practice the Jesus prayer. So anyway, thank you. Thank you.